and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name's Evan McGugan.
And I'm Chris Vaughan.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories, as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space. In this episode, we discuss SEC complaints against XRP, Binance and Coinbase, and we touch on a number of other financial crime topics.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Evan. How's things?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Not too bad at all. Anything new with you?
Nothing major. Got back from a summer holiday not too long ago, a little cheeky week away, which was very nice. I was in Barcelona, so certainly can't complain. Bit of beach. What about yourself? You're away soon, aren't you?
Yeah, away to Cyprus on Friday. So similar sort of thing. Looking forward to a bit of sun, bit of sea, hopefully some good food, and generally just recharge the old batteries. Any good food in Barcelona? Any highlights?
Yeah, I mean, you can't beat a paella. That's very authentic pronunciation right there of Spanish.
Paella?
That's probably better, yes. I'll defer to you on this one.
Chicken, chorizo, or seafood?
Seafood, gotta be, hasn't it?
Correct answer. Cool.
Right then.
So what's been happening in the world of financial crime over the past wee bit? Seems to be regulatory enforcement is back on the menu. Particular focus on the US Securities and Exchange Commission. I'm sure a lot of listeners and ourselves will have seen the SEC quite recently charging both Binance and Coinbase for violating several federal securities laws. I think this also comes at a time where the SEC's long-running battle with Ripple Labs, essentially over which the allegation was that they'd been offering unregistered securities since 2013 or so through its XRP token, is expected to come to a close fairly soon. That seems to be the main talking point over the past wee bit. And when delving into the US criminal code, I think it's quite easy to get lost in the legal definitions of maybe what is and what isn't a security per US law, which I guess ultimately is what all these cases come down to and we'll be touching on. So maybe if that's what we're looking at in this episode, I could very quickly set the scene, Chris, if you don't mind.
Sounds great. Let's dive into it.
Perfect. Great. So, yeah, I guess to very quickly and briefly kick things off, in the US, worth keeping in mind the definition of an investment contract. The existence of an investment contract is essentially what ultimately brings a transaction or an engagement into scope for being considered as a security, and therefore subject to the disclosure and registration requirements of both the Securities Act 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. There's something called the Howey test, and fully appreciate as well, sorry everybody, but in Northern Irish brogue, that's a difficult word to pronounce, Howey, H-O-W-E-Y. The Howey test basically refers to a US Supreme Court case, which was SEC versus W.J. Howey Co. for determining whether a transaction qualifies as an investment contract. Under the Howey test, an investment contract essentially exists if there is an investment of money in a common enterprise with a reasonable expectation of profits to be derived from the efforts of others. It's actually quite interesting. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole the other week looking into this, but it came about from a case in Florida where the aforementioned Howey company sold off parts of a citrus grove to third parties. Those third parties would then lease back the land to Howey company. Howey's own staff would ultimately maintain those groves and sell the fruit onwards, with both Howey and the third party investors sharing in the revenue of those citrus fruits. So you can sort of see in that setup how that fits that test. Break it down into four key parts. An investment of money, number one. In a common enterprise, number two, with the expectation of profit, number three, to be derived from the efforts of others, number four. So let's all keep that in mind. That's what a security is. And in the US, the SEC regulates the public sale of securities, which are essentially fungible or tradable financial instruments used to raise funds from capital markets, be they obviously public or private in nature. A security offering then is defined where you have the existence of an investment contract, the formation of that common enterprise, a promise of profits by the issuer, and then also the use of a third party to promote that offering. So that's the Howey test. That's the definition of what a security is, in the US at least, and how you sort of breach that threshold if you're conducting a transaction or a contract which fits into that. Moving on to crypto now and how this is applied to that sphere. You sort of look at the ICO boom as well of a few years back, which has obviously significantly subsided. And that's essentially due to falling in scope of those definitions, in scope for SEC regulation, registration, supervision, for obvious reasons. So that's a bit of background for everybody. Maybe we'll jump in, Chris, if it's helpful. Start off with the Ripple case. I guess it's the case that is probably coming to a conclusion over the next short while, obviously been going on for some years now. Do you want to walk us through what's going on there?
Yeah, can do. I think, first of all, that's a very, very helpful place to start before we sort of go back and forth on this. Isn't it interesting that we're talking about litigation and law that was dating back to the 40s to try and discuss whether internet money falls into the category of a security or not? Imagine if they could look forward from the 40s and see us discussing this imaginary internet money in these terms. It's quite bizarre.
So some things change, some things stay the same.
Yeah, it is. It's quite funny. But nonetheless, yeah. So I think the definition of a security and the, let's say, the development of the crypto sphere has always, it was always going to run afoul of each other eventually. It's not a surprise to anyone. And it was always coming in a certain sense. The XRP case, which is against Ripple, dates back to the end of 2020, but even before that, everyone was well aware that something like this is likely to happen. And interestingly, I suppose Ripple were just the first to fall afoul of it.
Yep.
So the allegations at the time were to do with, first of all, XRP itself being a security and that being issued by Ripple, and then secondly, part of the allegations were around actually selling those allegedly unregistered securities for the raising of funds, basically for the firm. So that was what the original complaint with XRP was, and it's really taken years through of litigation and going back and forth in the courts to sort of figure this out. And as Evan, as you've said there, it's really all around this definition of a security. It's interesting that not no other, but few other cryptocurrencies have really fallen into the same muddle as Ripple. And now we're seeing the exchanges getting targeted in a sense, I suppose. I don't know if that's a fair way to describe it, but nonetheless, Binance and Coinbase, the two. In Coinbase's case in particular, they actually list 13 currencies that have been mentioned and listed as unregistered securities or allegedly unregistered securities by the SEC. So yeah, that's really where we stand at the moment. But again, it's like everyone knows this is going to be a years in the making piece. Mm. But that gives the background, I suppose, that the XRP was the first one. And now we're seeing more cases from the SEC, and these ones targeting the exchanges themselves who are actually trading these coins.
So I guess Ripple and XRP essentially, you know, created at the outset, obviously investors coming in, that's the investment of money component. The common enterprise, I guess, is the development of the infrastructure, expectation of profits come out of it to be derived from the efforts of others. The SEC case seemed to be that the sale of XRP in the initial point was, it falls into the definition of security on the basis of its public and private sale. And the fact that it was then used to fund Ripple's business, i.e. XRP development, but also other Ripple Lab projects, that then being the common enterprise with XRP holders expecting profit from the effort of others. XRP and Ripple seem to be relatively confident from reading online of potentially coming out on the right side of this. I know there's been ongoing discourse with the SEC and potentially mixed messaging coming from at least individuals related to the SEC public officials in setting out definitions and such. I know that the SEC lost a few pre-trial cases involving Ripple. Ripple, for example, managed to obtain internal SEC communications on the definitions of whether or not Ether is a security and a few other coins. So yeah, I guess there's a wider question of what does this mean for the industry going forward. But maybe first off on that point, on Ether, is it or is it not a security? And then those 13 or so assets on the likes of Binance and Coinbase, these presumably will quite neatly fit into the definition of a security. But I guess the inference there is that some clearly aren't. So yeah, is there any cryptocurrencies in your mind that don't fit that definition, don't fit the Hori test? What would they be?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I will answer your question, but I'll mention the 13 because it's interesting. Yep. The ones that I suppose I'm not going to say they've picked, because they obviously have their own reasons. But the currencies themselves are Sol, so that's Solana, ADA, which is Cardano, Matic, which is Polygon, and then Filecoin, Sandbox, AXS, which is Axie Infinity, Chili's, Flow, ICP, Near, VGX, Dash, and Nexo. So a few of them will probably be familiar to some listeners, and some of them may not be. That's fair enough. Those are the particular 13. There are some quite clear anomalies that seem to be missing. XRP itself not mentioned there, which is very interesting considering the ongoing case against them and the whole case itself sort of impinging on the nature of whether XRP is a security or not. It's not been mentioned in the Coinbase case, Coinbase complaint rather. That by itself is sort of a question mark. And then you ask the question, what doesn't fit the definition of a security? And again, it seems to the onlooker, it appears that BTC, Bitcoin, is not really ever going to fit this definition. My point around Bitcoin specifically, I think, would be it's the decentralization that's the difference maker there. Bitcoin never issued by an entity. It doesn't represent, because it's completely decentralized, there's no representation of holding a stake in a firm or anything like this. It wasn't. The nature of its distribution, it's just different to the way that these other ones are, in many cases, have been issued, which sometimes is, as you say, through an ICO, or for the purpose of raising funds for a business, and quite often they're connected to an entity itself, which is said to have issued the token, which in Bitcoin's case obviously isn't applicable. But yeah, I mean, it's very difficult, and I'm being not an expert on securities law, unfortunately. I'm sort of, it's difficult for me to comment on that specifically, but those are the general sort of vibes in the industry. I suppose that's what people are thinking. XRP is a massive one that there are question marks over why that's missing. And then it seems to the onlooker that Bitcoin won't really ever fall within that definition for those decentralization reasons. There's another point around where the crosshairs have fallen now on exchanges in the US and sort of these huge trading companies, particularly obviously Coinbase and Binance, that there's question marks first of all around what the SEC were actually expecting these firms to do. Coinbase, for example, was approved for an IPO, and the SEC was fully aware of what Coinbase's activities were at the time of that, and yet was allowed to proceed. So there's just a number of sort of conflicting pieces of information and question marks over, well, hang on, what were we supposed to do? What was the right path? You know, if you're acting as the regulator, you need to tell us what we're supposed to do. And you had multiple opportunities at which you could have, you know, sort of pulled the reins, put the brakes on, and that didn't happen. So I do think, because I'm not close to the details of the case, it's obviously very difficult, but you do have to raise some question marks around why this hasn't been a thing in the past, I guess. I don't know if you've got any thoughts around that, but you know, there might be a couple of things we could talk about there.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. I guess the cases which have commenced against Coinbase and Binance. Certainly the Binance charge sheet, so to speak, is slightly larger and goes beyond just the definition of securities and securities exchange and so on. Now that the SEC is focusing on whether or not certain crypto assets come into their perimeter for securities exchange, and maybe through what they've sort of went through the Ripple case, and perhaps you flagging that XRP wasn't mentioned is maybe an indicator of where things are or aren't going in that one. But yeah, if they've went and defined what crypto assets are reasonably expected to be a security internally, then we might expect more of this now. So certainly Coinbase, I guess, obviously fall into the regulatory perimeter for AML supervision and so on, as they do in the ways they do. But on the basis of these changing definitions and a realignment on that from the SEC, by the nature of them doing the exchange, doing the broking, doing the clearing of what's now defined certainly to be a security, that's sort of the driver of this. And if that is the mood music and that is the way the SEC is going, then I guess probably we would expect the vast majority or all exchanges ultimately to come down on that or come into that story and potentially be on the SEC's radar, which is a pretty scary thought. And to your point as well, and to bring it back to the citrus fruits at the beginning. But, you know, whilst things do change, they do stay the same. And, you know, the perception of where things are lying has clearly changed over the past 5-6 years. And I guess the SEC is starting to come to grips with that now. I wonder too as well, and I'd seen some speculation on the internet around why these Binance and Coinbase cases were filed when they were, particularly when it seems like the Ripple case is coming to an end. And the inference was that Ripple may very well be successful in their defense to some degree. And the SEC now is potentially trying to, if not flex its muscle, then maybe regain a bit of credibility, particularly after, obviously, recent high-profile failures of VASPs and so on. But yeah, again, I guess, yeah, neither of us are certainly experts in securities law in the US, but it does seem like the regulatory perimeter and the expectations on VASPs and exchanges who provide a large degree of different products and services, the rules are only getting tighter.
Yeah, and all of this, you know, to contextualize again, all of this comes in the wake of FTX. So, you know, you've got to think of the SEC's role, which is to protect consumers. And you could argue failed to do so. You know, a lot of people lost a lot of money in the wake of the FTX scandal. And perhaps this is the SEC reaffirming its grip and, you know, and its position as a regulator. Not saying it's sort of a backlash against the cryptocurrency sphere necessarily, but it is a little bit sort of the SEC got burned in that instance and I guess sort of needs to demonstrate its controls now and can probably expect to see them get tighter. The overarching problem, I think, is also that it doesn't seem like for the foreseeable future, like US citizens are really going to have the right to be able to purchase cryptocurrency, because this kind of position and the strength of these complaints from the SEC are going to push firms like Coinbase and Binance offshore and yeah, abroad away from the US. You know, the last podcast we did, we talked about Mika, which is obviously the way that we were speaking about that then, bringing the regulatory clarity to the space in the EU, has really set, you know, it's flying the flag for cryptocurrency. It's saying, come and invest here, come and bring your companies to the EU because we're giving you clarity. This is what we expect. We're not going to leave you in the dark and then suddenly file complaints and cases and litigation a few years later. So it's not hard to see what will happen if more clarity doesn't follow from the US, that they will simply run all of the cryptocurrencies out of the US. That's just clearly what's going to happen, isn't it? You know, the market will respond.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point on potentially pushing crypto out of the US. Binance and Coinbase, obviously the two of them, have this charge of running an unlicensed securities exchange in the US, and the natural endpoint of that very well may be, you know, their withdrawal, full withdrawal from that market if it doesn't go down particularly well. The SEC in their engagement against Coinbase essentially had two charges: operating as an exchange, clearing agency, broker, and then the unregistered offer and sale of securities as part of that. And obviously there's clear reasons why that's important too, you know, giving people those adequate disclosures about the business and so on and so forth. The Binance charge sheet actually has 13 charges filed against disparate Binance entities, and also against the founder himself, CZ, Changpeng Zhao. And to your point on restrictions on US investors, there are some issues around, you know, geo blocks, but then actually them not being effective in nature. And maybe there's a lesson there to be learnt on the sufficiencies of geo blocking controls, not just for VASPs, but for non-VASPs as well. Misleading investors potentially on the existence and adequacy of market surveillance controls and tools, and a few other points. So the Coinbase one is indicative of, you know, the look forward position. I think the Binance one, you know, potentially is going to be a slightly larger case. But to your point, at least in, you know, from a UK perspective, from an EU perspective, the future potentially, if we're to link back to the previous podcast, is bright. And if we see firms potentially move out of the US, subject, of course, to meeting the requirements of MiCA and having everything above board in the EU, then, you know, that clarity that the EA and EU's providing on this could only hopefully be a good thing.
Yeah, indeed. And to sort of spin off that one, this is a much more recent piece, but did you see recently this piece of news around the UK working with the EU from a financial services perspective in terms of regulation?
I saw mention of, yeah, if not convergence, then certainly working closer together. I haven't had a good read into it just yet. Anything of note?
Yeah, I haven't really either. I just think it's Well, I'd like to think that it's extremely positive. And things like this around MiCA, I mean, we already talked about how MiCA is probably the template for which other jurisdictions may follow. And with that kind of agreement in place, you would think that something similar will come along for the UK as well, right? I don't know if that's something we can potentially dive into in a bit more detail another time, but I thought since we were spinning off that same topic there, it's quite an interesting development.
Yeah, very good point. Actually, I think we made the point in the last podcast on how, you know, US or UK Gov has positioned itself, or at least talks about positioning itself as a crypto hub, and the EU obviously taking the lead on things. So yeah, that's quite a well timed sort of coming together. There must be something behind it. So good to see, particularly after a few years of obviously post-Brexit difficulties and the memorandum of understanding on financial services cooperation taking as long as it did to come in. Yeah, we can only hope for some supranational cooperation going forward on all this, which ultimately is required, really.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. In the spirit of cooperation, did you see the news around the sharing of financial crime intelligence with the banks this week? That was UK only, I think.
Actually, not to a huge degree. So very happy for you to fill me in and to fill the listeners in as well.
Yeah, this is an interesting piece. It's not major, but it points in the right direction, I think, for financial crime particularly, which is sort of a pilot in which I believe the pilot is initially six UK banks are being allowed to share cases of, I think it's egregious sort of cases of financial crime which would point towards clear, you know, suspicious activity basically, and allow banks to basically move much more quickly in preventing these kinds of incidents and preventing, you know, just working together using all of their resources to be able to tackle financial crime more quickly. And it I guess that it may pave the way towards the sector coming together to share information more readily and to be able to swap information and to point others in the right direction. And it just, to me, just sounded really interesting. Again, not dived into it too much, and it is obviously only really early stages, but yeah, since we were talking about collaboration, I thought that one sort of sits nicely there, and that's an interesting one for people to go away and have a little read about maybe, and will be something to follow as it develops.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's in firms, we always talk about silos and how silos are a bad thing for obvious reasons. And it's always seemed to be the maddest thing ever that there isn't more information sharing between entities, individuals who are all trying to achieve the same thing. So, you know, you've got your KYC, your suspicious activity, risk indicators, real actionable intelligence, and to not have some sort of approach to share that and ultimately achieve what we all want to achieve has definitely held things back over the past bit. So I remember certainly with the super SARS and whatnot coming in 4 or 5 years ago, that was like an early portent of things to come. But this sounds, yeah, that sounds like a bit of essential reading to see how things go. And hopefully it's a successful pilot and it can lead to more effective financial crime risk mitigation.
Yeah, all interesting points, I think. And yeah, as you say, one to watch. Perhaps we can finish off this time round with a little dive into country risk again. So some recent updates from FATF. Yeah, we can perhaps talk over this, Evan.
Yeah, absolutely. Started off the podcast with discussion on holiday destinations, and I guess we'll end it with holiday destination chat too. Public service announcement. Yep. FATF, recent additions to the grey list are, if I recall, Vietnam, Croatia, and Cameroon. The UK obviously has set its stall out to say that its list of high-risk third countries in Schedule 3ZA of the MLRs will always mirror the FATF grey list and so on. There was a recent change to 3ZA a couple of days ago now at the point of recording, where they removed Morocco and Cambodia on the basis of their progress in remedying structural deficiencies, but they haven't yet added Nigeria or South Africa to their list. So not currently in line with the grey list, but the expectation is that we'll have a statutory instrument incoming at some point to add Nigeria, South Africa, and the three aforementioned countries, Vietnam, Cameroon, and Croatia to 3ZA in the future. So something to keep in mind, it will be coming down the pike. Get your country list registers updated and start thinking about how that'll affect your operating environment, how your controls will have to change, what your exposures are, and what efforts need to be done to ensure ongoing regulatory compliance. But thanks for the poke. Actually a very good public service announcement there.
Yeah. Took a little while, I think, for HMT to get round to the updates on this front. And as you've said, doesn't map directly onto the grey list anymore. But interesting development anyway. And don't know if there's any reason for that having taken a bit longer than usual. But now they're going to have to turn around and make additional updates again. So that's the way of the world. Yeah, so interesting one and one to be aware of. Yet another African country added to the list, which has clearly been a target, or at least has been where the crosshairs have fallen for FATF for a while now, and Croatia getting added as well, which is another interesting one. So all things to be aware of.
Absolutely. Always interesting when an EU27 country finds its way onto one of these lists. Obviously, Malta had its actually relatively short-lived time on there, but it'll be interesting to see the engagement that Croatia will have to do now to remedy the issues that I guess have been identified. And equally, maybe a nice point to end on, but it really sort of puts a bit of meat on the bones to the argument that you shouldn't just be whitelisting entire supranational organizations. You shouldn't just be saying, well, it's EU, so it must be low risk. This is a really good example why you have to undertake, and again, say it again and again, a multi-source, up-to-date, accurate assessment on a per-country basis.
100%. Yeah, we can all agree with that, hopefully. Perfect. So for me, that rounds things off this time round. Evan, is there anything final? Anything, you know, any other bits and pieces we need to cover off?
No, Chris, all good for me. I think a bit of mandatory reading for for everybody to go away and do a bit of digging. I'm looking forward to looking into this information sharing piece. But yeah, happy to close it there. And as always, enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, same, likewise. Right, we'll call it a day then. Thanks for tuning in again, guys. And thanks very much and speak soon. Cheers, Evan.
Cheers, Chris.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Partners in FinCrime podcast. If you want to get in touch with the podcast or for more information on governance, risk and compliance related matters, please reach out on our website at fscom.co or alternatively, send us an email at partnersinfincrime@fscom.co. That's partnersinfincrime@fscom.co.